At about 10 minutes after 8, with me this morning is Representative Peterson and his leg. He had a bit of an accident there, and I hope he's okay now. And Representative Wilson, who's a registered nurse, we got her sitting next to him. And we got Representative Johnson on the right, Vice Chair Seaton, and myself, Bob Lynn. This morning we have three bills to consider. We'll try to get through them all. HB 73 is a license plate bill. HB 123 is extending the Suicide Prevention Council. And HB 193 is regarding the Legislative Ethics Act. So, and I'd like to recognize that Representative Gruenberg has just arrived. Good morning, sir. And we'll begin with HB 73. And to present that bill is my Chief of Staff, Nancy Manley. So please identify yourself. I know who you are, but for the record.
Okay, good morning. My name is Nancy Manley, staff for Representative Lynn. Included in your bill pack is a committee substitute for House Bill 73. House Bill 73 started out as a license plate for honorary consuls, and then Representative Harris's office asked that we put in the firefighter and EMS medical services, in which we agreed to. And finally, some problems developed with the honorary council part of the bill, and it was decided to take that part out of the bill at this time. So now the bill is entirely for firefighter and emergency medical services license plates.
So we need to adopt the CS,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, so you'll need to adopt the CS, and we have some people online that can further explain what this
Okay, Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move the CS for House Bill Number 73, Version E, 312-09.
Thank you very much.
I'll object for discussion.
Okay, object for discussion.
Were we moving the bill or moving it for discussion?
Discussion.
For discussion. I'll remove my objection.
Okay, fine. No, we just adopted the CS, so we can go with that. So now this bill is exclusively about the firefighter and emergency medical service provider license plate. And our first person this morning to sign up to testify, I believe, is Susie Cochlick out of Valdi. Did I pronounce that right? Is she here?
Yes, sir, Mr. Lynn, I'm here.
Good morning, ma'am. Please introduce yourself for the record and tell us about what you'd like to have on this plate.
Mr. Lynn, I'm Susie Hill Koklich from Valdez. I represent the Alaska State Firefighters Association. What we're looking for here is basically a feel-good bill. This bill is to recognize and thank firefighters and emergency service workers around the state and in our local communities for the tireless efforts they put forward on our behalf and all citizens across Alaska. This will include paid and volunteers, and as you know, volunteers receive little or no compensation for the many hours of training they receive. And it's just a thank you. We've done this for veterans, we've done this for other organizations in the state, and we feel it's just time that we recognize the fire service, EMS workers in the state of Alaska.
All right, any questions? Representative Seaton.
Thank you. In the bill, we have three different fee schedules on page 2.
Do you have the bill in front of you?
Or is this more appropriate for
you? No, that's okay. Ms. Cochlish, do you have the bill in front of you?
Yes, sir, I do.
Okay. I believe he's referring to page 2, beginning, I think it's line 14, is that correct?
That's correct.
Have you had a chance to look at that?
I have.
Any?
What's the question?
I was wondering if you could give me the differences and the reasoning on the three different fees.
Yeah, and also, we also have Whitney Brewster from the DMV who can also address that.
Okay, I would have to defer it to Ms. Brewster because I did not have any part of this writing. This was done by legal as far as I know, and I am unfamiliar with this, and I apologize for that.
But no need to at all. Okay. Any other questions? I want to thank you very much for testifying so early in the morning here. Do we have Dave Miller out of Sitka? Are you there, sir?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Would you please introduce yourself and make some comments for the record if you'd like.
Yes, sir. My name is Dave Miller. I'm president of Alaska State Firefighters Association and a member of the FICA Volunteer Fire Department. This is one of those bills, like Susie said, that's just a great thing to recognize the volunteer efforts that are put in by approximately 4,000 people in the state. Our organization represents about 1,500 of those now, and we're growing every day. It's showing throughout the country that little bits of recognition like this really help in recruitment and retention of volunteers for the future, which we're sort of nationwide. Volunteerism in the fire service is low right now, and we're trying to do things to help that out. And this is one of those things. People can see that their neighbor volunteers, and maybe that's enough of a get-go to get them to volunteer too. And we just appreciate your support in making this bill happen.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Representative Wilson.
I just want for the record to know that I'll be able to get a license through this, so I just want the record for the record to let
now,
everyone know.
I'm going to ask you why, of course.
Because I'll be able to get a license.
Well, I mean.
And because I was a former EMT and worked for an ambulance squad when I lived in Tulk.
I guess I could, too. I was used to be an ambulance driver in Tucson, Arizona, many years ago, and drove ambulance and hearse. We always got the business one way or the other.
Mr. Chairman?
I do have a question.
Yeah. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I guess this is for any of the volunteer fire departments that we have testifying. On page 2, line 3, it says a fire department in this state, and the fire department is recognized by the state fire marshal. Are all volunteer fire departments recognized by the fire marshal?
Sir, this is Dave Miller. There are about 250 recognized fire departments in the state of Alaska. There are a few, and I'm guessing maybe like 15 or 20 that aren't registered at this time, but we're working on that to make it happen.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm wondering if, I mean, I don't want to broaden this any further, but whether you volunteer for a recognized fire department or an unrecognized fire department, you're still putting your life on the line when you go to the fire. So I don't know if we want to maybe address that in some way. And I'm not sure I know how, maybe the sponsor, but I would hate to exclude someone who's doing the same job as someone else just because the fire marshal hasn't officially recognized them. So I just put
so
that on the table.
Kick it around the committee here?
Just put that on the table for discussion. I don't know.
Representative Seaton, Vice Chair Seaton.
Thank you, and Mr. Chairman, you know, I totally agree. I am a little concerned, though, that if we don't have some classification, then anybody can say that I'm a volunteer firefighter in my subdivision, and it's not recognized. But if they say that they are, the question is, who would certify that there's a? I mean. And I'm not
agree.
Opposing.
I don't know. That's why I pose the question. I don't know the answer. So.
And so maybe we can get that later. Thanks.
Okay. Representative Wilson.
I would like to think about, I think we need to think about making a change, because not all EMT programs, and like the one in Tulk, wasn't affiliated with the fire department, but it is recognized. And so maybe it could say, an active firefighter and or emergency medical service provider, instead of just saying and, because that means they have to be both?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Let me go to Whitney Bruce with the DMV, and then we'll bring this back to the table on this particular subject. Yes,
Mr.
Representative
Chair,
Grunberg.
Yeah, just if Ms. Brewster could make a list of questions.
Well, we don't have Ms. Brewster here yet.
Great.
Whitney Brewster, are you online?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'm here.
Please identify yourself and make any comments you'd like, and I think the committee may have some questions for you.
Certainly. For the record, my name is Whitney Brewster, Director of the Division of Motor Vehicles. The DMV is in favor of this legislation. As some of the committee members referenced, the DMV it is wanting to address, and hopefully that someone online could do this, how the DMV would know whether someone was active or former, what sort of proof would be provided to the DMV to be able to identify them as a firefighter or an EMS provider.
Okay. Mr. Miller, if you're still online, do you have the answer to that?
Yes, sir, I'm still here.
Yeah, do you?
And we'd be willing to work that out. I mean, we could have, you know, we could come up with forms that the fire chief and the or emergency service personnel could have their leaders sign, you know, to take to DMV to prove that to them when they had to re-register their plate. We'd be willing to work that out anyway to make it easy for them.
Okay, thank you. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And maybe this is a question for anyone who can answer it. I don't know if we have anyone from the Department of Law, but is there any kind of law or statute against impersonating a firefighter? Is there something that – I know there's police. I know there's other, but I don't know if there's something about impersonating a firefighter. And if someone wasn't official and they had the plate, would that subject them to some type of impersonating a fire department? So that may be a way around.
I mean, I would assume that would apply to other – plates like Purple Heart and so on.
I would doubt there's a law against Purple Heart. Maybe there is.
Representative Grunberg.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, yes, there's a federal law against impersonating the acquisition of a medal. And I forget the name of it, but it's written up in the newspaper not infrequently because people get caught for doing that. There's definitely a federal criminal law for claiming you have a medal when you don't.
And then as the firefighters.
Well, I'm going to look that up.
Excuse me, Representative Glenn?
Yes, Ms. Kosler?
It was our intention that the individuals do go to their local fire department for certification. Mr. Miller was on the right track there. Any individual wanting a plate, whether they be active or retired, would have to go to their local fire department for certification, and they would have to carry that paperwork to DMV to be issued the plate.
Okay, thank you. Representative Johnson?
Ms. Miller, thank you. And maybe you can answer the question about fire departments that may not be recognized by the state fire marshal. Do you know of, and I understand there may be some that are, and how would those be handled?
Would you identify yourself for the record, please? My clerks are going to hit me over the head here.
All right, this is Susie Koklich out of LDs with the Alaska State Firefighters Association.
Thank you.
It's my understanding, and I've been an active volunteer since 1979, and so I think I know a little bit, but it's my understanding that the departments that are not recognized are primarily off the road system, and in a lot of these small departments, they don't even have vehicles to drive. So we're talking about a very small percentage of the population. And as Mr. Miller pointed out, we are continually working with these small departments to get them registered with the State Fire Marshal's office. And this is an ongoing effort, and hopefully we will have all departments within the state registered, within a few years. But they're small villages. As I said, most of them don't have vehicles, and that's probably the bottom line.
Thank you. Any more questions for her? Reverend Grunberg, did you find the site yet? Okay, please share it with us.
Yes. Okay. There are several impersonation statutes. Criminal impersonation in the first degree under AS 1146-565 does not apply because this doesn't deal an access device or a identification document of another person. That doesn't apply. However, AS 11.46.57, criminal impersonation in the second degree. A person commits the crime of criminal impersonation in the second degree if the person, one, assumes a false identity and does an act in the assumed character with intent to defraud, commit a crime, or obtain a benefit to which the person is not entitled, or pretends to be a representative of some group or organization and does an act in the pretended capacity with intent to defraud, commit a crime, or obtain a benefit to which the person's not entitled.
And I assume a license plate would be a benefit.
I believe so, and that's a Class A misdemeanor. And then there are two others, Mr. Chair. There's AS 11.56.827, impersonating a public servant in the first degree. A person commits the crime of impersonating a public servant in the first degree if the person violates AS 11.56.830, which I'll get to in a minute, by pretending to be a peace officer and purports to exercise the authority of a peace officer in relation to another person, and that's a Class C felony. And I'm not sure whether a firefighter is a peace officer.
I wouldn't think so.
And then the second one is AS 11.56.830, impersonating a peace, by the way, that 827 was a Class C felony. 830 is impersonating a public servant in the second degree. A person commits the crime of impersonating a public servant in the second degree if the person pretends to be a public servant and purports to exercise the authority of a public servant in relation to another person.
That would cover a firefighter, I would think.
It's not a defense to this prosecution. This is sub B under this section that the office pretended to hold didn't in fact exist, or he was in fact a public servant different from the one pretended to be. And it doesn't apply to a peace officer acting within the scope and authority of the person's employment. That's a Class B misdemeanor.
Yeah, I think it's pretty well covered, and it's pretty obvious then to me at least. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I want to make sure that we get it clear on the record that that somebody driving a car that has this license plate on we are not considering that impersonating a firefighter.
If I were to drive the car, but my wife is a firefighter, that would be okay.
Absolutely, because otherwise we're going to, just by our legislative record here, establish that only the single person can operate the vehicle.
Well, we have the same situation here. You know, I have a legislative license plate, but the wife drives the car.
And Mr. Chairman, I just want to make sure that on the record we don't tend to extend this on these plates to saying that we're impersonating a firefighter if you're driving a car that has a firefighter license plate. I just want to get that on the record.
So I'd assume it'd be somebody, a firefighter, who's registered the car themselves or in joint registration with their spouse or somebody. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate Representative Seaton clarifying that, but what I was more interested in is obtaining the license. If you obtain the license under false pretenses, then you would be, and that kind of covers for me the fire marshal certification question here, so kind of takes that kind of off the table for me. So I appreciate the driving part, but the obtaining part I still want to maintain is a...
Is anybody else on the line? Just one moment, please. Representative Grunberg?
Thank you. Mr. Miller, again, your position, sir?
I'm president of Alaska State Firefighters Association.
Okay, I need to ask you a question.
Go ahead.
Chair. AS 11-81-900, subsection 44, defines peace officer as a public servant vested by law with a duty to maintain public order or to make arrests. Do firefighters fall in that category?
My best guess would say no.
Okay, if that's the case, then it would only be, wouldn't be under 827, 1156, 827.
Well, let me ask this to the President. If I'm watching firefighters fight a fire someplace and Mr. Miller or Ms. Koklisch tells me to move back and go across the street and I say no, is there any penalty to that because they're acting in authority as a firefighter? Can you give me orders, appropriate orders, that I'd have to follow under penalty if I don't?
I could probably order you to do that, but I don't think I have the power to arrest you to do that.
Only at a citizen's arrest, I suppose, like any of us would have.
Right, sir.
That's correct. Mr.
Chair.
Representative Grunberg.
It says, with a duty to either maintain public order or make arrests. I assume that firefighters can maintain public order at a fire. Can they not, sir?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Well, anyway, they would at least, Mr. Chair, be it would be impersonating under AS 1156-830. And I do have some questions for Ms. Brewster, if I may.
All right. Ms. Brewster, are you still there?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. It's Whitney Brewster with the DMV. Representative Grunberg.
Whitney, you were a little muffled there. If you could maybe speak into the mic or something. Anyway, I have several questions for you. First of all, if you look at the CS, maybe this is for Mr. Miller, for either one of you, I guess. It says...
Where are you?
I'm on page 2, lines 3 and 4.
Okay.
A fire department in this state and the fire department is recognized as a fire department by the state fire marshal. Are base fire departments in that category?
Yes, sir.
Okay, that was Mr. Miller.
Yes.
Second question. If we have military people, and this goes to not just military. Well, let's talk about military people first. It says, in this state, let's say we have a person who is a firefighter in the military stationed on base, but they go on active duty over to Iraq, where they are acting as firefighters in Iraq. They're deployed. Should we not, and this is for Mr. Miller, shouldn't we allow that to be considered also if they are TAD or whatever they do, they're deployed to Iraq?
Representative Wilson?
On that point?
Yes, on that point.
Don't we have a veterans' license plate?
Oh, yes, but I'm talking, if that, may I respond to
you
Representative
may.
Wilson? Yes, and they would be entitled to that, but I'm saying, should we not allow them to get these firefighter license plates if they're stationed on the base and they
temporary duty overseas?
You're deployed for 6 months or a year.
That's
and then they
temporary.
Come or whatever. I mean, the thing that concerns me is it says in this state.
10 years.
We'll get to that here in a minute. And also in this state it also says 10 on line 9. It would seem to me, and I'm asking Mr. Miller this, that those would be folks that I think should be able to qualify under this also. What do you think, Mr. Miller, through the chair?
I would think, sir, this is Dave Miller, I would think that would be fine as long as the chief of the base department was willing to sign off on that they were allowed to do that.
Okay.
And I would think this would be something that the fire people, the chiefs and so on, who sign, you know, they can make these determinations if something comes up that's iffy. I don't think this bill needs to cover every possible contingency that might occur.
Mr. Chair, what I'm wondering is because Ms. Brewster, on line, you see, if you look on page 2, line 3.
I am there.
It says a fire department in this state. Now, if you have somebody who is stationed on a particular base, or, frankly, could have been a firefighter for years and be in the military coming onto the base have been, let's say, on other bases or something like that. The thing that bothers me is it only counts service in this state, and the military may only be here for a while, but frankly, having these plates may be of assistance to firefighters. It sort of identifies them if they're in an emergency situation.
Well, I would just make a comment that I would interpret it for this. If you are in the military and you're a firefighter on Elmendorf or Fort Richard or any other military thing, you're a firefighter there, you should probably be able to qualify for the state. If you get transferred to Peru or something, you're no longer here, and when the plate expires, it expires in normal course of business. And I don't know if we need to drill down this deeply into that. This is a case where the local firefighter people can make those determinations.
Ms. Brewster, would this language that's currently in the CS, this is Representative Grunberg, through the chair.
We know it is. Go ahead.
For the record, this is Whitney
Brewster,
Director of the Division of Motor Vehicles.
Yeah, Whitney, you're fading out badly.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, much better.
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, the Division of Motor Vehicles, how this would logistically work is that an individual with the form would come into the DMV and provide it to the DMV as proof that they are an active or former firefighter or EMS provider. The Division of Motor Vehicles would look at that form and see that, yes, indeed they are, and issue the plate. If it is the intent of the legislature to include those that are on base, of course the Division of Motor Vehicles would honor that.
I'm through the chair.
Quickly.
Ms. Brewster, the thing I'm concerned about is on line 3. A fire department in,
state.
Yeah, okay, that's fine.
Like the Almendar Fire Department in this state.
Okay, yeah, I see what you're saying. Okay.
Okay, I think we've exhausted that topic. I also have Carrie Henning and Stacy Oates with the DMV. It says here to answer questions. Do you have anything you could add to this? If not, is anybody else online you'd like to testify in this bill?
Michelle Weston, Alaska Fire Chiefs Association.
Yes, I didn't get your name.
Oh, Michelle Weston.
Yes, Michelle, would you please identify yourself and make your comments?
Hi,
I didn't have your name here.
Sure, I'm Michelle Weston, Alaska Fire Chiefs Association. I've been listening. I think this is a doable bill for us as the Fire Chiefs Association. I think we can work with DMV and work on certifying individuals. I think the majority of Alaskan communities are served by volunteer firefighters and emergency medical technicians that routinely leave their families and job day and night to provide service to local communities. And so we join with the other firefighter associations across the state to urge your approval for this. And a comment that hasn't been brought up yet in your discussions, it would be put in other states, funding or revenue from these plates have been put back into volunteer firefighter organizations or to juvenile fire setters programs, similar to the Children's Trust plates, which the funding, my understanding is it goes back into the Children's Trust Foundation. So I'd like to see that happen with this.
Mr. Chair.
Right. And I think that'd be a laudable thing, but I'm not sure we can do that because most of these things have to go back into the general fund.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gruenberg.
If the members and Ms. Weston, Chief Weston, would look at line 29 on page 2, the reference there is that the additional money in excess of the cost may be appropriated by the legislature for purposes provided in AS 1443.085, and that does just what you were talking about, Ms. Weston. It's free tuition and fees for a spouse or dependent of a peace officer or members of the armed services or a fire department. And these make, it's a fund set up that makes a dependent or a spouse enrolled as a student in good standing in a state-supported educational institution entitled to a waiver of undergraduate tuition and fees. If that dependent child or the spouse was related in that manner,
right.
To a firefighter.
Did I say may or shall?
May. It has to say may on line 28, otherwise it's a dedicated fund. But it covers peace officers, members of fire department who died from an act arising out in the course of employment as a peace officer, firefighter, or duties of a volunteer firefighter.
Okay, good. I don't want to read the entire statute on everything here. Okay. Michelle, where are you located?
I'm Deputy Chief with the Anchorage Fire Department.
Anchorage, that's what I thought. Thank you very much. Anybody else online I didn't have a name for? Anybody in the audience would like to testify in this bill? If not, I'll close public testimony, bring it to the to the committee for discussion and possible action. Representative Seaton.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, Ms. Brewster raised a question that I don't know if we answered, and that was she was wondering what was satisfactory proof. Could she tell us whether she needs more definition to that, or whether working with the fire departments and Department of Health and Services, they can work that
okay,
out?
Okay, I thought she said she could, but Whitney Brewster, please come back.
This is Whitney Brewster, Director of the Division of Motor Vehicles. Through the chair, Representative Seaton, I believe I received my answer that DMV will work with the various associations to devise a form that would identify an individual appropriately under this bill.
Great.
Thank you, Ms. Chairman. And can I
continue?
Ms. Brewster, I don't know. I think maybe this question's for you. And that's on page 2, lines 13 through 20. On the fee schedules, we've got a $30 for an active, $50 for a former, and commemorating the firefighters, emergency medical service providers, 100. I haven't seen that commemorative to somebody else, so I'm trying to figure out if somebody was wanting a commemorative firefighter and emergency medical plate, they wouldn't. Would they have to satisfy the conditions of
A and B?
Active, I mean, it seems like they wouldn't satisfy the active or the former. Does that mean that anyone can get a plate commemorating firefighters and emergency medical service providers without being a member of any of those services?
In other words, could I go down and ask for a plate if I coughed up to $100? Because I like
through the chair, Representative Seaton, it's my understanding from reading this CS that yes, anyone who wanted a commemorative plate could obtain it by paying the $100 fee plus the $35 fee on line 21.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any other questions, Ms. Brewster, Representative Peterson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a question from Ms. Brewster. On the fee schedule for the plates, is the state of Alaska making money on these? Are we breaking even? We make money on the expensive ones and lose on the cheaper ones. How does that all work out?
Through the chair, Representative Peters, the cost of plates per set is about $10 to the state. So the remaining fees collected would go into the general fund.
Thank you.
But under this bill, the DMV would account for those fees collected in excess of the cost. Lines 21 through 30 on page, I'm sorry, 21 through 29 on page 2, we would account for those additional fees.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Wilson.
Thank you. Ms. Brewster, my question is, these three different categories for obtaining license, will that be for the same license, or is the license going to be different for active, former, or commemorating?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, it's my understanding that this is establishing a special plate, but perhaps I'm not correct on that.
Well, I was assuming that, but I didn't know, so I thought I'd ask.
Good question. Okay, any other questions for Ms. Brewster while we have her? If not, any further discussion on this bill? If not, I'll entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Seaton.
Chair, I would move CS for House Bill 7326 LS0303/E from committee with individual recommendations and attach
zero
fiscal note.
Okay, thanks. Okay, without objection, this bill is passed in the committee. Thank you very much for those who've testified. And we'll continue now to the next bill, which is HB 123, Extend Suicide Prevention Council. Good morning. Please identify yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Crystal Keenum and staff to Representative Anna Fairclough. She does send her apologies. She is up in House Finance right now, and they're doing due diligence on budget stuff.
At least she made it back from the eruption.
Absolutely. What we have before us today is House Bill 123, which extends the statewide suicide prevention council. Currently, the council is set to expire June 30th of this year. What we're asking is to extend it until June 30th of 2013. I can go into details about the council, Mr. Chairman.
How long did it run previous and the life is still going on? How long was the previous period? How many years?
I believe it was 4 years.
See, so this would be
the same.
Okay. Any questions?
Yes.
Representative Seaton first, then Representative Grunberg.
Thank you. Was there a legislative budget and audit done as part of the sunset on this? I didn't see it in my packet.
I don't know. I don't believe so, but I can get that information to you.
Okay, thank you. And I believe we have somebody from budget and audit in the audience that maybe we could call up later. Thank you.
Okay, Representative Grunberg.
Yes, I usually there is, and that was my question too. If we could have the lady from legislative budget and audit come up and tell us about the audit.
You would have me ask her to come up, right?
Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Sorry.
Good morning, for the record.
Good morning.
Pat Davidson, Legislative Auditor, representing the Division of Legislative Audit.
Good morning.
Morning. In accordance with statute, the Division of Legislative Audit did conduct a sunset review on the Board of Suicide Prevention. As a result of our review, we do recommend a 4-year extension. The statutes now allow for an up to an 8-year extension. However, we made a recommendation for 4 years for this board. One of the reasons is that this board is having difficulty getting people appointed to the board. The last time we did the review, we made a recommendation to the governor's office that they be more timely with their appointments. This year we ran into the same problems, had a better discussion with them, and our concern is that the qualifications for appointment to this board are too narrow, and our recommendation to the legislature is to consider broadening out the membership requirements for this board. You're looking for people who are interested and willing to serve, and when the restrictions about who exactly should be on the board, it's so narrow, you reduce that pool of people who are willing to serve. And so our recommendation for continued operations of this council is that the membership be broadened out a little bit. Along with that, 4 members of the legislature are appointed to the board. And our recommendation related to those appointments is that they be non-voting members. Not trying to take a voice away, but they're having difficulty meeting their quorum. Basically, we look at it and they're running about 51-53% attendance at the meeting for this 15-person board. And it's difficult to get your business done when you are fighting that quorum issue.
How often does the board typically meet in 1 year?
Mr. Chairman, I believe this board was meeting just a couple times a year. It is surprising. It is active. You know, the statutes surrounding this board talk about it as an advisory council to the governor and to the legislature, and it provides a list of areas that should be that they should be aware of. And what we found is that the council is actually active in some of those areas. Rather than making a recommendation to the governor or the legislature that something be done, the council is actually doing some of those things, which is, again, one of those areas that why we recommended extension for the council.
Where does the board typically meet?
Mr. Chairman, I don't know off the top of my head.
Okay. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You mentioned that you want to change the parameters of qualifications for appointment to this group, and I was wondering, are you having problems getting volunteers to work with the suicide prevention group, or why exactly did you want to, you say you want to broaden the scope, but are you having trouble getting the number of people you need?
Through the chair, Representative Peterson, yes, in our review of the council's activities, we found that overall appointment and attendance at meetings was running around 54%.
Good.
The vacancies, when we looked at the board, or I'm sorry, the council, most of these are boards, this one is a council. When we looked at it at September 30th, of a 15-member council, there were three vacancies, and they had been vacant for quite a while. When you look at the qualifications for membership, there are things, a person who is a secondary school counselor, you know, that would be one of those areas where you could go, could be a school counselor, not narrowing it to a secondary school, or if secondary school is the important feature, then maybe they could be a teacher as well as a counselor. If you broaden out that membership, you're going to get a better pool of people.
Right, or through the chair, or a retired former student counselor or something, you know. Right. Okay.
Thank you. Is anything being done to broaden that out?
Mr. Chairman, the requirements are in statute, so it would have to be the legislature that would make those changes.
Okay. And I don't know if anybody's working on that. Anybody here? Representative Seaton?
I think the
Representative Seaton?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think that with the sunset here, I think that would be, the sponsor would probably be looking at that. And so... in conjunction with the committee. So, thank you.
Okay, Representative Grunberg.
If we could ask Crystal to come up, I think she can answer that question. I think we all have the same question. We need to look at these recommendations and see what needs to be done in this.
Because this is going beyond the scope of the actual bill we have here, but I think it's very important we consider this.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the record.
Apparently, it's not so much do we extend the termination date or not, but is the council acting as well as it could because of inherent difficulty of the way it's put together.
Absolutely. Mr. Chairman, for the record, this is Crystal Keeneman, staff to Representative Fairclough. We had initially introduced this bill as a companion bill to Senate Bill 35, which Senator Davis is carrying. They have been looking at the composition of the council and are working and taking steps to find the right composition and make it, you know, a well-oiled machine. Our concern is, one, we are running late in session. This does sunset this June. We're more than happy to take a look at the composition of the council and make it better. I know we're just wanting to make sure that we don't let this
expire while you're trying to bring it. So in other words, many of the questions we've asked here or have been brought up here are being attempting to deal with this in the bill that's making its way through the Senate, right?
Yes, sir.
And which we may not hear at some point this year. Meanwhile, we have to keep this thing in being so we have something to modify.
Absolutely.
Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Any other questions while we have her here? Representative Grunberg?
Yes. Crystal, is that other bill moving?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Grudberg. It is currently sitting in Senate Finance.
Oh, okay, because I was going to say, if I think we're all concerned about what we're hearing from you and Ms. Davidson mm-hmm. here, and I have great respect and confidence in Senator Davis and the folks on the other side.
Absolutely.
But I'm wondering, would it be any help to put something in so we can start moving something over here with the expectation they'll meet up? Would that save any time through the chair?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, I don't know. I don't know the dynamics over on the Senate. I just don't. And like I had said before, our main concern is making sure that this council does not sunset.
Well, I think we probably ought to contain our concerns here to the termination date, and then we can independently check in that bill and the other body down there and see what's happening. But this bill, do we extend the council or not? And if so, for how long? Representative Seaton?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, the thing is that we in statute require legislative budget and audit to do an audit of each one of these agencies before we sunset them so that we review them for improvements. And if we don't make the improvements, I mean, we have legislative budget and audit doing an audit on this, and then we're going to ignore the recommendations in our legislative budget and audit and rush through a sunset. And it seems like we won't get it up until it comes up for a sunset again. So if there are provisions incorporating our legislative budget and audit recommendations that are in the other bill being considered, you know, to mirror that, we ought to be considering those in the Committee of Jurisdiction. That would be us here, is my opinion, Mr. Chairman.
I think those points are well made, because what do we do here? This is going to expire in June. What are we, 3-4 weeks away from going out of session here? And the other bill is in Senate Finance, in the middle of everything else over there. Are we going to get anything back in time to act on before we do this? I'm wondering if maybe we ought to hold this until we find out what's happening over there. What's your thought?
And Mr. Chairman, my question is, if they have a bill that is in the other body's finance committee and we send something that is over that is totally different than what they have in their body, then there's a conflict, because ours would be the vehicle and they would have to modify ours, and it would have to be come back across. So if we would incorporate the changes that legislative budget and audit have been acted here, it would actually speed up the process, because both vehicles would be incorporating those changes, and we wouldn't have conflicting that would have to require a concurrence vote.
Is there any
Mr. Chairman,
any comments on that from the sponsor's representative?
It is the will of the committee. I mean, you do have the
power. We know
power
that.
To.
We know that. But we want to do what's
our,
most appropriate.
Our only concern is to make sure that we don't let this council sunset. That's our main concern. We'd be more than happy to mirror the Senate's bill. My only concern is wanting to make sure that we do, you know, get this through with the 27 days that we do have remaining, and April 16th is the last day to hear bills. So that's just where my concern is.
Are the recommendations of the legislative audit in Senator Davis's bill?
I do believe that they are.
Mr. Chairman, this is Pat Davidson for the record. I have been attending those hearings as well, and my understanding from those hearings is the Suicide Prevention Council actually met, and I believe February sometime. They came up with recommendations, passed those along to Senator Davis's office, and those were what were incorporated into the bill. That's my understanding from listening to the testimony during those hearings.
Okay. Representative Wilson.
I think it would be a good idea for us to do a committee substitute as a committee and get that get the wording so that it's the same as the Senate, so that we don't have as far to go. That would help them, because they've only got to take it to the floor, and if we did the same, then they could meet and I think maybe that would be good. And then, but do it as quick as we can so that we can get going with it. So, like,
well, I can assure you, we will, keep this at the top of the list because it's very important counsel, I think. But any comments on what Representative Wilson said?
Mr. Chairman, like I said, it is the will of the committee.
I know. Any other comments? And I think we may just hold this. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I think that we do need to get a copy of legislative budget and audit sunset review and look at the recommendations that have been made by the legislature for improving the function of the council to make sure that we have considered what we've asked our legislative budget and audit to prepare for us. So I appreciate that.
Okay. I'm going to keep public testimony open, but for now, I have Diane Costo with Behavioral Health. Are you here? Please come up. And you've heard the conversation here. You might have some comment on this.
I do indeed. Good morning.
Oh.
My name is Diane Casto. I am the manager for Prevention and Early Intervention Services with the Division of Behavioral Health and Department of Health and Social Services. We are the division where the Statewide Suicide Prevention Council sits as of July 1. Prior to that time, the council sat in the commissioner's office, but last year it was the decision of the commissioner to move the council into the Division of Behavioral Health to be closer to where the suicide prevention activities are happening at the state level. So the goal was to mirror and to integrate the activities of the council with the activities of the division so that we're working in conjunction with each other. So at this point in time, I am myself and one other person are staff to the council in addition to our other activities. So a couple things that I wanted to bring up. First of all, the Department of Health and Social Services does support this bill. We would like to see the council continue. We feel that, as all of you know, reading the newspapers, that suicide is a huge issue for the state of Alaska. We are working very diligently to change those numbers and to start dropping the rate of suicide in our state through a number of efforts. We have a number of grant programs that are working out in our communities. We have just received a $1.5 million grant from the federal government, the Garrett Lee Smith Youth Suicide Prevention Grant. We feel that right now things are really starting to pull together and the council is a huge asset for the state of Alaska and for the Department of Health and Social Services to provide guidance and direction in the work that we're doing. We do have, as was pointed out in the previous testimony, following the sunset audit, the council had a meeting in February 4th and 5th, and did have a discussion related to the audit and the recommendations, and came up with recommendations for tweaking the membership, not huge changes, but such as the school counselor, making it broader, because the goal there is to have someone who works in a school or is involved with school-based activities. So let me just see if I can quickly find my, and I can make sure that all of you get a copy of this. The recommendations that were made by the council was to change the language to an employee from a secondary school system, such as but not limited to a teacher, administrator, counselor, nurse, or other school personnel. The wording was changed a little in the CS, but basically the CS in the Senate took the language that we put forward. So the changes that were recommended by the council were to, again, tweak a few of the areas that we have the most difficulty in filling, and the one additional change was to add a public member. Currently, we do not have a public member other than that fits a certain category of descriptive category. So we support the current CS that is in Senate Bill 35, and we believe that the composition would meet the needs of the council. Also, just on a good note, we are fully represented at this point in time. All seats have been filled, so we feel very good about that. And it's the first time in a long time that we've had a full council, so we're very excited about that and have a great group of people. One additional question that came up after we had made our recommendations for the CS was related to adding that public member, which in essence then gave us an even number of council members, and in often you want an odd number for breaking ties. And one thing we've never had is a contentious issue. It's a group that is pretty works through communication.
You've never had to count chads or anything.
Yes, we've never had to come to blows over voting. But one of the recommendations, and I did put out a request to the council members to get their input on this, if they felt that was going to be an issue or how they would like to see that handled. You know, there's a couple things that could be done. We could add a second public member, but we hesitate to do that because we felt within our existing budget we could absorb one additional member and the travel for that person for meetings. But with two additional members, that would increase the budget, and we would not like to do that. But following Robert's Rule of Order, we can make sure that the chairperson does not vote unless there is a tie or to create a tie and thereby kill a vote. So we feel that even with an even number that we are that it will work fine for this group and it will not cause any undue hardship.
And what if I may ask, you've heard the conversation about maybe mirroring the sunset bill we have before us with the bill in the Senate. I think it's SB 35.
Yes,
what are your thoughts on that?
Mr. Chairman, we support that.
Okay. Any questions? Representative Seaton.
Thank you. One of the other issues that was brought up was the having the legislative members be non-voting. Did the council look at that, and did you take a position on that?
Through the chair, yes, we did. What we would like to do is continue to have four legislative members on the council, but in more of an advisory role. It is very difficult for, as you all know, for legislators to come to a two-day meeting, and so their attendance has been very spotty. And when we let me go back to also to clarify this, one of the other questions that was asked earlier is about how often we meet and where do we meet. The council meets quarterly, and we try to meet every year once in Juneau during the session so that council members can have an opportunity to meet with their legislators. We meet once a year in Anchorage, and the two other times we meet in outlying areas. This year in September we met in Sitka. We were supposed to meet in Kotzebue in the winter at one point, but the flights did not get in, so we had a second Anchorage meeting that time. But that's the goal. So again, that has been prevented the legislators often from coming and spending 2 days at an out-of-town meeting.
I was wondering, too, if a legislator votes on something in the council, then that same issue comes before us in the legislature on a committee. Is there potential for a conflict of interest? Or where you might vote one way in the council, another way in this committee or another committee or on the House floor?
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure that would be. I think it would depend upon the issue at hand. But we feel that being in an advisory role gives us that advantage of having legislators participate and be active in the conversation in helping make
I would think
decisions
that,
about.
I would think that would be
issue.
Better. Where you don't have to put your go on record there when you may change your mind when it gets here. Representative Grunberg. And we got to get to the next bill here soon. Go ahead.
Every time I ask
yes,
before,
right.
I can say anything.
Yeah, that's right. It's called preemption.
It's preeminent. I would be very interested. Do we have anybody from the council here today?
Through the chair, no. They all were They all knew about the hearing, and I guess unless there's someone out online, I don't believe there's
anything. I would hope that the next time we revisit this issue, we could have the chair of the council. I'm interested in knowing Our federal fund, is this a council that's required to get federal funds?
Through the chair, no, it is not.
Okay.
At this point in time, the budget is only GF dollars for the council.
Okay. Did the, and I guess maybe you've seen, I'm sure, the LBNA report. Did that report or did the council in its deliberations take up any other legislative reform or amendments that would be recommended or regulatory for that matter, other than the composition of the council? Are we dealing with any other issues, the powers of the council, or anything? Should
through
we
the,
be?
Through the chair, are you talking about that came up in the audit?
Or in deliberations.
Or in deliberations.
Yes, you're the staff of the council.
In terms of the audit itself, there the only other recommendation related to staff of the council, and there is a staff person, a coordinator, that's identified in the description of the council and its makeup. With the change in location of the council, there was a let me backtrack just a little bit. As I said earlier, the council changed from being with the commissioner's office and moved into the Division of Behavioral Health. At the time that change was made in July, there was not an opportunity for hiring a new coordinator because we needed to make some decisions about the funding. When the position was in the commissioner's office, there was one person who did a number of different jobs and did a job share with a number of different councils, served as a chair or coordinator for the Medicaid Review Board.
So the recommendation, to cut to the chase, was for to have better staffing?
To have the make sure that the council had the opportunity to make a determination who their staff was. We just, myself and another staff person were kind of appointed because we got the position, the council got put into our division.
Through the chair, has that problem been cured?
Yes, it has been cured.
Okay, so there's nothing else other than the makeup of the council?
That's correct.
Okay. Yeah, I am interested, having served on a board like this many, many years ago, to see how this works and what we should be doing. And I'm glad that the committee is going to be dealing with this issue and would welcome any further advice from the committee itself. And I don't know how you can communicate this request to the other members of the committee and any other documents you want to provide to the committee through the staff that can be distributed. I'd like to see, you know, what you've been, your recommendations are in this area too. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. With that, I'm going to ask Crystal if you're going to assist in putting this together, and I want to get this back before us as soon as we possibly can, because it's the desire of the chair that we not let this council expire, but also that we do everything possible in one package if we can. And so, Representative Seaton?
Thank you. And could I request that we get a copy of the legislative budget and audit sunset review?
Yes.
And the recommendations of distributed of the department distributed to the
excellent
the council?
Excellent idea.
Thank you.
Okay. Is anybody else online or in the room need to testify? Okay. If not, I'm going to hold public testimony open. So when we bring it back, and I'll bring it back as soon as we can. Thank you for bringing this to us. And next is going to be a thing we've heard of before, legislative ethics, HB 193.
Morning, Mr. Chairman.
Good morning.
For the record, Mr. Chairman, my name is Reneva Moss, legislative staff for Representative Coghill, and I have with me Joyce Anderson, who is the executive director of the Select Committee on Legislative Ethics.
Good morning.
We're here to introduce House Bill 193, which is a product of much discussion with the Ethics Committee and amongst legislators.
Get a little louder, please. Thank you.
House Bill 193 is the product of a much discussion with the committee and the Select Committee on Legislative Ethics and amongst legislators. It addresses about half a dozen issues within the ethics laws that the Select Committee, Representative Coghill, and others that I'm looking at right here think need to be discussed and refined. So at your pleasure, could I just do kind of a section-by-section analysis?
Yes, and if I, we have a CS before us. Could someone speak to the what's in the CS compared to the original? And Representative Wilson, did you have a...
I was just going to move that we have the CS in front of us.
Yeah, we want to make the motion for that.
I move CS for House Bill number 193, version S. And that's before us for discussion.
Do you object for discussion purposes?
I do.
Okay.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. The changes in the CS are in the definitions. If you go back to the original bill on page 7. On the CS, also page 7, we have changed some definitions. One is the definition of constituent. The original definition limited a constituent to a person living in your election district.
Now you're on line 24 in the CS.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. The new definition makes it a natural person to whom a legislator owes the duty of representation under the Constitution of the State of Alaska. While we're on this definition, Joyce Anderson and I have had some discussions this morning about what the real intent of defining constituent is, and perhaps we're trying to define the wrong word. Constituent is used in the ethics laws controlling campaigning, and by defining constituent this broadly in this section of the law, we're causing other problems.
You mean in the original bill?
In both bills,
okay.
Mr. Chairman. So in our discussions this morning, quite frankly, I think what we're looking at is defining the word person. You want to give the cite, Joyce?
Mr. Chair, Joyce Anderson with the Ethics Committee. The definition of person is in 01.10060, and the definition of person includes a corporation, company, partnership, firm, association, organization, business trust, or society, as well as a natural person. So the definition of person is very broad.
And Mr. Chairman, the reason we think person is more appropriate is because what the committee is having problems with is 2460.030A2, and just let me read it to you.
Please.
It is the use of public funds, facilities, equipment, services, or other government assets or resource, or another government asset or resource for a non-legislative purpose, for involvement in or support of or opposition to partisan political activity, or for the private benefit of either the legislator, legislative employee, or another person. So person is the thing that should be defined within this section, not constituent, because if you look at 2460, constituent is used, for instance, a legislator, let's see, get back to the original. This paragraph does not prohibit a legislator from sending any communication in the form of a newsletter to the legislator's constituents, except a communication expressly advocating an election. So if you define constituents broadly, then what you're saying is a legislator could send a newsletter statewide, and it could be within a window period very close to an election. It could be a House member who is running for a Senate seat that sends his newsletter to two House districts, which under current law would be unethical. So in using the word constituent, we could be changing, there could be a lot of unintended consequences. So our recommendation is that we simply either eliminate the definition under 17 or just reinsert the definition of person as it applies in this section to
Mr. Chair.
Representative Grunberg.
We're distributing the statute defining person now. I personally am very glad that it would seem to me that the one way of dealing with this, one way of dealing with this would be simply to substitute on line 24, striking the word natural. So it means a person to whom a legislator owes a duty of representation. And I know that some people have ethical concerns about sending your newsletter outside your district. I don't. I think a legislator has a duty to exercise free speech, and that's a core form of free speech, sending one's newsletter out. And if, in fact, somebody feels you're using public funds for campaigning, I'm sure that's going to be a major issue in the campaign. And the public will frown on that. The people around here aren't dumb in this state. And I think the legislators really should be able to get their newsletter out to anybody in the state they want, because we have a lot of people, each of us, who don't live in our district who are very interested in what we do. And I think we have a responsibility to keep the people of this state who are interested in our activities informed. So that's my view.
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, I just want to clarify what you were proposing here.
Well, the thought was, Mr. Chair, that I personally like the idea of being that we don't just represent natural people, human beings. We represent groups of people too, and the definition of person, and I've handed that out, Mr. Chair, that is here, subsection 8 in the handout, AS01100608. It includes a corporation, company, partnership firm, association, etc., groups of people, as well as a natural person. And, you know, at least for the purpose of communicating, it would seem to me if somebody wanted to notify, send a copy of the newsletter to Providence Hospital or to Exxon or to the Shriners or whoever, they should be, you know, that certainly we represent groups of people too.
Yes, Ms. Moss?
Through the chair, I just wanted to confirm, is this an amendment, Representative Grunberg?
You're not at this point.
No, we're just discussing. Okay. And the thought would be that we could simply say constituent means a person to whom the legislator owes a duty of representation, et cetera, strike the word natural, and then you're back in the definition of 01100608.
And through the chair, my concern is that
Ms. Moss?
What the committee is trying to define or clarify is this subsection in 2460.030A2 that talks about the use of public funds and facilities. The word constituent is not used in that subsection. The word is another person. So my concern is we're defining constituent, but the problem exists in the word person. And
what is the statute reference?
It is 2460.030A2.
Representative Wilson?
I'm a little bit confused now because...
Me too.
I'm going to get this.
I thought that we were discussing number 17 to change that to person and then use this definition, and then Representative Grunberg said to leave out the word natural, but now I'm a little confused.
I think we have to get
and
duplicate.
I'm confused too, because a duty owes a duty of representation. I don't represent the Shriners or the Providence or somebody.
Well, may I?
Yes.
I in my district, I have my district, but Prince of Wales Island, I don't have any of that. But Prince of Wales, I'm the closest representative that lives the closest to them, and they call me quite some quite a bit, and they know me where they don't know, you know, really. Bill Thomas is their representative, but he lives clear up in Haines. And so, you know, there are times I sure don't say, well, I'm sorry, but you're not my constituents. And so, I mean, I help them if I can. And so there are times when something like that comes up that you do because it's just the right thing to do.
I think we all do that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so I think we need to make sure that it's okay for us to do that.
Mr. Chairman, I think she brings up a good point, and a constituent certainly could be defined as a person as it is here. I just think we need to clarify that a person in this subsection is defined as it is in Title I.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I think that when we're defining, when we're putting this definition in here, we've got to look at all the different places where that might. Now, where we have other statutes and other relevant things, and if we're defining constituent this way very broadly, all of a sudden, Exxon and BP are my constituents. And I'm not sure that under campaign laws, we don't allow contributions from them, but we're defining them as my constituent. And I want to make sure that when what ramifications this goes through and whether we are narrowly defining this. Right now we're not defining this paragraph to mean constituent in this section. It could mean broadly throughout the statute we're defining constituent. And so we've got to look at where we've used constituent all throughout the ethics and APOC and everything else if we're now defining constituent broadly throughout the statute.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Seaton, if this actually is a definition in this chapter, that's how it is read in Section 246990, definitions A in this chapter, these words are defined in this manner.
And Mr. Chair, if I could comment for a second. Through the chair, Representative Seaton, there are two sections in the ethics statute that use the word constituent. And one of them is the one that Rhineva referred to, where it talks about a constituent sending out a communication in the form of a newsletter.
And where is that?
And that's in 2460.030A2J.
And is that in the materials that we have, or is that just in the statute book?
We need to duplicate the rest of this.
Probably not. also, for Nancy's purposes, it's also in 2460.030E. 030 is the section in the statute that talks about conflicts of interest, and it is mentioned in there twice. It's not mentioned any other place in the ethics statute. Those are the two places. The one in E talks about constituent service. It says a legislator may not directly or by authorizing another to act on the legislator's behalf, state or imply that the legislator will perform or refrain from performing a lawful constituent service. As a result of a person's decision to provide or not provide a political contribution, donate or not donate to a cause favored by the legislator, or provide or not provide a thing of value. And there is a definition of thing of value in the statute under the definition section. So constituent service is talked about in this particular section, and constituent is the only other time it's used when it talks about a newsletter. So those are the two places.
Representative Greenberg.
We're getting that statute duplicated so everybody can see what we're talking about here.
That would be nice.
Let me ask, Ms. Anderson, Ms. Moss, through the
chair. Greenberg.
Are there any other statutes that you would recommend we get duplicated now while Allison is out?
Should
no,
we
I would suggest just 030.
Just
030.
Okay, we're doing it.
Do you want me to continue, Mr.
Yes,
Chairman?
Yes, go ahead.
Constituent services, same kind of issue. What we changed in the CS is we took out three words at the end of this definition, and that's of the legislator.
Where are you here?
I am on page 7, line 28.
Okay.
So a constituent service now means assistance including representation other than legal representation and advice other than legal advice that is provided by a legislator or a legislator staff to a constituent. It no longer reads constituent of the legislator because we're defining constituent, and that's not necessarily someone who lives in the legislator's district. It could be someone else.
Good. Would you do that again, Blake, that last part?
Yes. We took out the legislator because we want to make it clear that a constituent could be someone other than a constituent who lives in the legislator's district.
That's what I want to make. So I can give advice to almost anybody, even though they're not in my district.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, as long as it is a legislative purpose,
yes.
It doesn't matter where the constituent lives.
Okay. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And the effect of those two taken together, yeah, especially if we would remove natural, would mean that we have the same ability and the same refraining from anything with any corporation, any trust, any person in the entire state of Alaska. So constituent just means any entity or person within the state of Alaska. As I read those two things together, what I come up with is there is no such thing as a constituent other than anybody that has any issue that they want us to work on. Those are our constituents.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Seaton, that is Representative Coghill's intent.
And Mr. Chairman.
Representative Seaton.
And so I guess the other question is, it's not even the state of Alaska. This can be anyone because it's not limited to this. State of Alaska, it's limited to any natural person to whom a duty owes a duty of representation. Can that be any business that's or corporation that's practicing or participating in anything within the state of Alaska?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, yes, as long as the benefit to that person or corporation is no greater than the benefit of anyone in that same class. That would be a permanent fund dividend. Child support, OCS, it could be Department of Natural Resources. As long as that person is not treated in a better manner than any other person in that same class would be treated.
So,
Representative Seaton?
So let me follow up with a question. Let's say we had a Canadian mining company that wanted to do something in my district, or no, anywhere in the state, not in my district. And we had a 10-hour restriction before. The 10-hour restriction is removed so that I could have my legislative staff expend as much effort on permitting or anything else, as long as that would be the same amount of time that I would basically expend to any other mining company.
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, I would leave decisions like that to the Ethics Committee.
and through the chair, I'm not suggesting anything other than trying to get a reading of what we're doing when we have this wording in the statute where we remove natural person and we're removing anything about the voting district or anything else, and it seems like we are very broad at this point.
Representative Grunberg, and then Reneva, and then Joyce.
Through the chair, I think that Representative Seaton, in the hypothetical he gave, would probably be correct. I think it is important that we as legislators be allowed to exercise our plenary authority, and it may be efforts to attract a FedEx to come to Alaska, or dealing with a pipeline that may be owned or operated by companies that are headquartered outside the state or the country. We are in a global economy, and it is most important that we be allowed to exercise the responsibilities we need to do without running foul of the ethics law, as long as it's done honestly. That's the issue. And if it involves sending people newsletters and stuff so they can see what's going on and inviting correspondence and communications, that is essential, at least I believe, in the exercise of my own duties. Sorry to get on a soapbox. That's just the way I feel.
And Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Reneva Moss.
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, the only reason I was hesitant is I thought I heard you say staff assisting to prepare paperwork for permits, and I think that would be one that you would have to step back and say, am I going beyond a legislative purpose?
Yeah, right.
And that's why I was hesitant, and that's why we have to be careful, because when you get to fine details like that, that is what the Ethics Committee is for, to determine whether or not you've gone too far.
Okay. Go ahead, Anderson.
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, that's exactly what I was going to point out. You, as a when I talk to offices about constituent service, I talk about stating that you are the person there to help them through the process. You're not to do the process for them. So there's a little bit of difference between, you know, here's the resources that you can have, you know, here's the contact person and so forth. But for you to actually, your office to actually fill out the permits and have your staff do research and so forth, that's where the difference comes in. So I think what Reneva is trying to point out and Representative Grunberg pointed out as well is that even though this would open it up to allow you to work on some of those other issues that you referred to in your example, it still puts some constraints on your office based on other parts of the ethics code as well as what you can use state resources for. And also there is a definition of private benefit that is in here as well, which we're going to talk about in a minute. So we're getting into the area of where there are certain things that are allowed under the statute and certain things that would not be based on what exactly the action is going to be itself that you're proposing.
Okay. Reneva Moss, you got it? I'm fine. Representative Grunberg?
There is something I very much like the language on lines 24 and 25 with the exception of the word natural for a different reason.
I'd like we're back on page 7?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We're only talking about that one thing now, Mr. Chair. And that is, this is in some ways modeled on a very interesting statute from the state of California that's in a different area dealing with jurisdiction. The question is, what is the jurisdiction of courts and the laws of a state? And that state law says the state, the jurisdiction of the courts are, they have whatever jurisdiction is permitted under the Constitution of the United States. It is called a long-arm statute. And our long-arm statute in Title IX, in the beginning, has been interpreted the same way, even though it's written a little longer than that. And I have, in a different context, a taxing context, a few years ago, suggested language like this, and I think it was adopted, but this basically says that we can represent folks to the extent permitted under the state constitution. And that's a great idea because it preserves the separation of powers. And it allows us to do our work to the extent permitted under the state constitution. And whoever thought of this, I applaud.
Through
I never would have
thought
of that.
Representative Grunberg, it would probably be no surprise to you to know that Representative Coghill came up with those words.
Really?
Yes.
Well, that's great.
That'll be in my next newsletter. All over the state.
My hat is off to him. That's really a good idea.
Thank you.
My next newsletter goes every place.
Mr.
Go ahead.
Chairman, and continue on with definitions. Legislative purpose, we have changed that to be broader also. The old language was means a goal of the a legislative action or a constituent service that is a primary goal or when measured against other goals of the legislative action or constituent service is a substantial goal. That pretty much put us to sleep. So we have changed that to say a legislative purpose means a goal of a legislative action or a constituent service. You have defined both of those words, and we feel that is enough. What we did do in changing that is we did ask legal to define a private benefit clearer. And when I first read it, I didn't think he had done a good job, but after reading it three times, basically what he is saying is, as I said to Representative Seaton, as long as the benefit does not exceed the same benefit that would be applied to any other person in that class. And that would be an example. Permanent fund dividend, yes, they are gaining something financially, but it's something that every other citizen who is eligible for a dividend is entitled to and received. And constituent services, as all of you know, usually comes when something happens wrong in an agency. Something has gone awry, and it has cost a constituent a right or an entitlement. And it's the legislator's duty to see if he can correct that wrong, be it child support, child in need of aid, assisting parents work through the process of getting the counseling that they need that's required. A couple of years ago, you'll remember House Bill 53. There is a legislative purpose to constituent services because most of what was in House Bill 53, which was the Family Rights Act, were issues that had been brought to one legislator or another in child in need of aid laws that needed to be fixed. And that's a legislative purpose. If we're taking what goes wrong with government and making it right through legislation, then what we're doing with that constituent definitely has a legislative purpose.
Mr. Chair, if I could comment.
Joyce Anderson.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I know I had a discussion with Rhineva a few minutes ago before the meeting, and I'm concerned about the word financial and the definition of private benefit. And the reason is that we already have a definition in the definition section, which deals with, and all three of these terms have the same definition, anything of value, benefit, or thing of value. And that talks about whether it's tangible or intangible. And it also says that could reasonably be considered to be a material advantage of material worth, use, or service to the person to whom it is conferred. And the terms are intended to be interpreted broadly and encompass all matters that the recipient might find sufficiently desirable to do something in exchange for. And so I'm pointing out that I feel there could be a conflict here between the definition that's being proposed in the statute with private benefit, looking at the definition we already have of benefit. And I would suggest that we remove the word financial, because when you're saying private benefit means a benefit, then you're referring to the definition of benefit, and then you're qualifying it further with what a private benefit means versus just a benefit. And I think that would probably help with that definition, because since we already have this, and it talks about intangible or intangible, financial is more tangible than anything, and so that would be my recommendation, Mr. Chair.
Representative Seaton.
And are you talking about on page 8 of the CS that we're discussing, on line 2 and on line 4, right? Both places?
That is correct.
And line 3, too?
Is it? Oh, and line 3 as well?
I'm sorry, I didn't catch line 3, yes.
Mr.
Chair. So your recommendation would be to remove that word financial?
Mm-hmm. Through the chair, we have no problem with that.
Okay. Make a note of that, will you? Grunberg.
I've just asked Ms. Moss, Ms. Anderson, should we also distribute a copy of the definitional sections to everybody so they can see that?
That's probably okay. Possible, Representative Grunberg. I know you asked earlier.
Allison, to do that, please. Thank you.
Representative Seaton.
Mr. Chair, under the kind of proposed definition that we're talking about on Section 8, when you combine legislative purpose and constituent service, it actually, to me, reads legislative purpose means the goal of a constituent service means assistance, including representation that is provided by a legislator or legislative staff to a constituent who is any person who has or corporation who has any interest in anything in the state of Alaska. And is that, and that's the intent, so that legislative purpose now means the goal of a constituent or corporation that has any interest in the state of Alaska.
Mr. Chairman?
She's nodding her head, yes.
And I'd like to Joyce Anderson's take on that, because I think when you read them together, I mean, we may as well just throw the whole thing out, because we're saying that you can basically do anything for anybody, and not only what you do, but as long as it accomplishes their goal.
Mr. Chairman, I think that is not what we're saying at all. And that's why we have in the definitions the fact that it can't be more than what the benefit would be for any person in that class. And again, I go back to the permanent fund dividend. That doesn't mean that we can go out and solicit contracts for someone or a corporation. What it means is if they have a right, if something goes awry with state government and they have lost something they were entitled to, just the same as anyone else was entitled to it, that is a legislative purpose. Legislative action is defined.
Just for clarification, and I'm just looking at the wording of it. I'm not talking about where our intent is. I understand that. But under legislative purpose, we're saying means the goal of a constituent service, and we've defined constituent service as including representation provided by the legislator or the legislative staff to a constituent who we've defined as anyone who has any interest in anything to do with the state of Alaska, and it's their goal, not the actual service provided. And when we get down into specific things like permanent fund dividend, I totally agree. But we're talking about the goal of any constituent, not, I mean, as I read the wording. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, the goal of any one constituent is not the goal of a class of people. I think what you're describing is an independent goal of a person versus the goal that could be shared by a class of people.
Mr. Chair, if I could comment real quickly. Mr. Chair, through the chair, Representative Seaton, I agree with your comments, and I hadn't really looked at that until you pointed it out, but to me, I agree with your saying that it's a goal of constituent service. Possibly we could say legislative purpose means a goal of legislative action or providing constituent service. And then what we're doing is we're not using that it's the goal of a legislative purpose, but we're providing constituent service. And I think that would be clearer for the Ethics Committee as well. Because when you say a goal of a legislative action, and there is a definition of legislative action, and even though we have a definition of constituent service, it's not really a goal. It's just providing constituent service.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just think the wording needs to be clarified, and I haven't considered exactly how, but it could be read that, you know, whatever your constituent wants is.
I assume we're keeping track of this, so we have, I guess, a conceptual amendment at some point here. Somebody keeping track of where we're going with this?
Yes, I am writing.
Okay. Yeah.
And Mr. Chairman, just for the record, legislative action means a conduct related to the development, drafting, consideration, sponsorship, enactment, or defeat, support or opposition to or of a law, amendment, resolution, report, nomination, or other matter affected by legislative action or inaction. So it is defined, I think, fairly well.
Reverend Greenberg, had a comment?
No, I'm preempted. No, I don't at this point. I think this is excellent conversation.
He doesn't have a comment. Make a note of that.
I would like Joyce to go over that last part again where she said, I think it was on 19 with legislative purpose. Would you go over what you said again?
Would you make the first, I distracted. What did you say? What was the question?
The question was, she said it, and I just want to get it in my head a little bit better because I had liked what she said, but I want to hear it again.
Know what it is she said.
Yeah.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson. First of all, I'll read what I suggested as maybe a word change on line 29 where it says legislative purpose means a goal of a legislative action or delete A and put providing constituent service. And I was agreeing with Representative Seaton that we don't, and I hadn't thought about it before, that we probably don't want to say that legislative purpose is a goal of a constituent service. We want to say that it's a goal of legislative action which is basically what your duties are as a legislator, but then also or providing constituent service. So we're making it clear that legislative purpose includes constituent service, which has not been in the statute before. So by using the word providing instead of saying keeping it as a goal.
Mr. Chairman, it makes perfect sense to me now.
Good. Reverend Greenberg.
Could we have a couple of moments at ease, please?
At ease?
Mr. Chair.
So they can hear.
Okay. Yeah, this is Representative Greenberg. It might be that this is sufficiently important that we would hold it maybe on Saturday morning, and then we deal with just this one bill, and the subcommittee could do its report. And if anybody else had any suggestions for this bill, you could announce on the floor that we could consider those and just deal with the one bill on Saturday.
Yeah, I think so. So rather than scheduling for Saturday at this point, let's get the subcommittee going and see where we are, and then we can bring this back just as soon as possible.
Yes.
And so it was the committee agrees. I would like to appoint a subcommittee to go over this. We need to get a well-drafted either CS or amendment to cover what we've been talking about here. And I would appoint Vice Chair Seaton, Representative Greenberg, and which one of you two would like to volunteer? I want to have a third person.
I'll do it, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, good.
Okay.
So, Mr. Chairman, just to clarify, when will this bill be brought up?
Like, one, when you're ready for it, and two, hopefully no later than this Saturday.
Yeah. May I make a request?
Take this off.
Well, here, just let me... we could. How long do you think we need to go on with the bill after we get the report of the subcommittee? I guess what I'm.
Mr. Chairman, all I need to do after that point, definitions are. I think the main discussion here is to outline what the rest of the bill does.
Okay. So why don't we? I've got the subcommittee now. Why don't you move past the definitions and go to the rest of the bill? So when we come back, we only have to do the definitions. Is that a good idea?
Works for me.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
So tell us where we need to be looking.
Section 1 of your CS, page 2. What we've tried to do here, Mr. Chairman, is draw a bright line on what legislators and legislative staff can do. And basically, we will discuss with the subcommittee additional language that we have to make it clear that once a constituent has filed a official appeal and has asked for an administrative hearing, at that point the legislator and legislative staff back away from the issue. It is now in the hands of an administrative hearing officer, and the exception to that rule would be if a legislator who is an attorney is representing this person as an attorney and is being paid for that service. That is allowable. However, it will be reported to the Ethics Committee, the income.
May I have a question on that point, please?
Reverend Greenberg.
Thank you. I think just for the record, Ms. Moss and Ms. Anderson through the chair, that it is possible that somebody could be providing representation. For example, an accountant in a taxing situation can represent somebody. So I would like the record to reflect that other professions can fall under this totally ethically, and I just wanted to put that on the record. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Perhaps we could put language in there that covers professional licensing.
Through the chair, I think the language is great.
Okay. Section 2 deals with gifts, and this goes to the discussion of charity events and tickets. The committee has discussed this in length. What they would like to see is the allowance of a lobbyist giving a ticket or gift from a charitable event, but that gift being limited to $250. Section 3, which the change is actually on page 5, this allows people other than a lobbyist's immediate family or someone acting on behalf of a lobbyist to give gifts of charitable tickets or gifts from charitable events over $250. However, Section 4 requires that that be reported, so there is disclosure in Section 4. Section 5, am I going too fast?
No, you're doing fine.
Section 5 just puts in statute to clarify that if a disclosure is against the law, either federal or state or constitutional, then that disclosure does not have to happen. It is protected under the ethics laws.
And, Mr. Chair, as an example, would be through HIPAA or something like that,
right,
that an individual has a financial relationship with someone who is a legislator, a legislative staff person, a lobbyist, or a public official, and medical field is the first one that comes to mind, and based on the medical laws, which would be a federal law or other law, that that there's a confidentiality issue. So this allows for that.
Representative Grunberg?
I strongly support this, and this relates to a bill we previously heard, and Representative Johnson and I had a dialogue about that. This also would protect the right of privacy for people in family law clients and people like that in certain cases.
Okay,
I think
very Wilson.
This is a very good section. I support it.
Representative Wilson.
I'm going back to it might be, I think, just number 10 there on page 5. Does that mean, like, if I'm using this as an example, the coming up skits and somebody has bought a table and they've invited you to that table, do the legislator have to report that, or does the lobbyist have to report that?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, that would not be over $250. It's a $20 ticket, so it's not even reportable.
Okay.
Okay. Continue, please.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Section 6, this implements a compensation for public members of the Select Committee on Ethics. It's $150 a day compensation while they're in meetings. Section...
Yeah. Well, we had a question. Representative Seaton?
Yes. On Section 5, you know, there's been some questions about real estate brokers or folks with real estate licenses and those interactions as being not reportable or not those financial transactions. There's other sections of law that says that those are confidential. Does that have any effect on Section 5?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, yes, it would. Anytime there's a state or federal law or by the Constitution that it's confidential, what this allows for is it allows the person who would have to make the disclosure to give the committee something in writing as to why they will not make that disclosure, and then the committee takes a look at it, and based on what the committee would do is look for the law to make sure that that statute, you know, definitely says that, or whatever the law happens to be, and say, okay, fine, it's confidential by some other statute, so you do not need to report that. So anything that would be confidential, as it says here, by the United States Constitution, the Constitution of the State of Alaska, or state or federal law.
Okay, Reverend, continue.
And Mr. Chairman, I'd just like to ask the Joyce to provide us with a list of those that are known that are confidentialities, like real estate disclosures and those kind of things.
Okay.
So that we know the parameters of what we're talking about.
Okay, Reverend Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think the Constitution of the State of Alaska guarantees everyone a right to privacy. Mm-hmm. So would that mean anything that you want to be held private would be private?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, I would have to ask legal to answer that. My intuition is no. That if information that otherwise would be public is by law confidential, then it would remain confidential.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, if I might.
We're running out of time here. Representative Johnson?
If someone's salary is confidential, that's not confidential by law, that's confidential by policy of a company, but I think that would be covered under someone's privacy, under the Constitution as a privacy issue.
Mr. Chair, may I respond?
Grunberg.
There's a series of cases on that, and the Supreme Court in at least three cases has delineated the contours of disclosure in these circumstances, and I'm sure we can get a legal memo on this, but it's not just your salary's confidential. That's they haven't gone that far.
Okay. Continue. We have, what, about two more sections?
We have one more section, Mr. Chairman, and that is a section that does a couple of things. It creates
Which section?
Section 7, I'm sorry, starts on page 6. And what this does is it does two things. First of all, it allows for an alternate public member. We have alternates for legislative members, but not for public members. This initiates that, and it also provides that if an alternate starts a proceeding, the alternate finishes a proceeding. They run through the 1, 2, 3, 4 meetings, whatever it takes to address an issue and make a decision.
Okay, fine. I think that does it. I would want to make a point. I'd like to appoint a chair of the subcommittee to be Representative Seaton. That's acceptable. And we have Terry Thurman, Chief Administrative Officer. I can't read the rest of this. We have just about 1 or 2 minutes, sir. Are you online?
No, she's back.
Back. I'm sorry. Apologize for waiting so long here.
No problem. I can be really brief. My name is Terry Thurman, and I am the Chief Administrative Law Judge for the state, which means we hear an awful lot of the executive branch administrative adjudications that are affected by Section 1. And my comments are entirely confined to Section 1 of the bill, and they are, in short, that the goal is laudable to make brighter line to limit inappropriate contacts. The way that the bill in the CS was originally drafted doesn't preserve two things that I think are important to preserve, and that is the ability of a legislator or a legislative employee to participate in an administrative adjudication as a party or as a witness, not just as somebody's attorney, but as a party or a witness without running afoul of the ethics laws. And then the second thing being the solution to inadvertent ex parte contacts, which is in the subparagraph 2 of the original provision, which was put into law initially when our office, the Office of Administrative Hearing, was created in 2004. I have, however, discussed with Representative Seaton and with Ms. Moss the concerns at much greater length than with Ms. Anderson, and my understanding is that there may be an amendment that I think was originally planned to come in perhaps at the Judiciary Committee stage, or perhaps they'll take it up with your subcommittee.
Okay. So, and I'd wonder if perhaps this could be addressed at least to some degree in the subcommittee.
Yes.
Oh. With that in mind, I don't think I need to add anything else, Mr. Chair, unless there are questions.
Any questions? If not, thank you very much. Again, I apologize. We don't have much time here at the end.
No problem.
Again, we have on the Thursday schedule, we have over your Public Officers Commission, and this has to do with this is about the electronic reporting that they're trying to put together. We'll talk more about that later. We had SB 29 naming of this office building, and depending on what the subcommittee does here, we may attempt, if we can, to bring this bill in on Thursday, but somebody advised me we'll make changes accordingly. Okay.
And Mr. Chairman,
Representative Seaton,
I'd just like to note that as soon as I can schedule that meeting will be that the time will be sent to all committee members, and you know, if you wish to,
well, everybody in the committee is welcome.
Yeah, that's what I mean. But we'll make sure that we send that notice.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Sub-Chair, I would ask that you would make an announcement on the floor about this also, and let them put it in the calendar, because there, and also there may be some other members who would like to prepare and offer amendments to the bill and subcommittee, so that we let them know too. I know of at least one person who may want to do that.
That would be up to the chair of the subcommittee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
That's a request.
I don't think I want to wait till Wednesday, yeah, so I can make an announcement of a committee meeting.
Yeah.
So I will broadly distribute it, and I'll get it to the
members.
Speaker's office and the members. But
yeah, that. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yeah. No, but it's coming for the committee. We are adjourned at 10:05.